Hey there, welcome back to Sauce and Bound. Today with me is Ed from Cloud Capital. I've heard so much about you guys. I've been talking to your director, which is, in my view, correct me if I'm wrong, is a very mystical creature in early stage startup. So maybe you can tell me a little bit more about the titles of Cloud Capital. But yeah, happy to see you here. Let's talk about you. Let's start with your background because, well, you just 5 minutes ago realized that your first SaaS was, what, 2006?
2006. I've been doing this a while, for sure.
Exactly 20 years ago. There should be like a little firework behind me.
Yeah.
But yeah, how did you get to do it in 2006?
Well, the world was a different place back then. The internet was definitely a different place back then. But yeah, that was my first startup. It was a bootstrap business called Ideomag, which was a consumer internet startup back when that was a really cool thing to be doing. And we started that fresh out of university with my co-founder at the time. And it was a bootstrap business we ran for several years, scaled it up quite nicely, certainly to be paying the bills and more so. And that was great fun. We ran that until probably 2011, 2012. And then I think we realized that we didn't really enjoy consumer tech businesses quite as much as we had expected, and kind of pivoted that over and reset ourselves and built the first SaaS business, proper B2B SaaS business that we launched called Ideo in 2013. That was a VC-backed business, so we raised capital from a VC called Notion Capital, which was kind of very early in the kind of European VC landscape, and we ran that as a B2B software business, scaled that in the UK, first of all, and then out into the US. So I spent a good amount of time over in New York helping to scale up the go-to-market side, which was great fun. This was sort of an AI startup before that was a cool thing, selling to large kind of enterprise companies and financial services businesses. And we built out a pretty good scale business. And then we sold that to a private equity fund in 2019, end of 2019. So that's a while ago now as well, which was also a really interesting journey. Sort of scaling business and then selling it on to private equity and understanding how they work with businesses very differently. I then took on a kind of interesting role where I switched sides from founder to M&A, and I led corporate development and M&A. And we went on a bit of an acquisition spree over COVID, over the lockdown kind of period. And we went very quickly. I think we did 5 more acquisitions over the next 18 months, scaled that up to a business of about 400 million of revenue very quickly over that time period. And I led those kind of acquisition processes and got to look at a lot of SaaS businesses and, you know, both bootstrapped and VC-backed businesses very quickly over that time period. That's now a company known as Optimizely. So we acquired a West Coast business called Optimizely and then rebranded the group as that name and went through that journey and actually ultimately ended up coming back out of Optimizely and spending about 18 months working with Notion Capital, my old VC backers, helping their portfolio companies on building scaling businesses. So kind of went through that entire journey from the founder side to the dark side with private equity, and now back again founding Cloud Capital about 18 months ago. So it's been a really good journey.
Yeah, it's super interesting. It was actually like one of the questions, because I obviously looked at your LinkedIn profile and I thought, okay, so after an acquisition, because we talk about all that journey post-acquisition and integration with an acquirer, who does what and what founders choose as their new path. And with you, it looked like, yeah, from being a founder and CEO, you went to product strategy, then corporate strategy, then strategic advisor. And I thought, was it more of a pull? So that's where your skill set was the most valuable, or did you just want to try something that was completely different?
I, you know, was aware that post-acquisition, you kind of have to let go a little bit of the business. You've obviously spent a lot of time building and nurturing, very hands-on. You know, part of that acquisition process is to allow, you know, the acquirer to take over the strategy of your particular business and, you know, particularly in our case, mold that into and blend that into larger business. I actually was very intentional. I sort of said there are a few areas which, as a founder, I never really got time to spend, you know, the amount of quality time that I wanted to. So particularly around product was an area that I was, you know, obviously really interested in, having kind of been a product-led CEO, I wanted to spend time there. Also around partnerships. So, you know, I never felt we quite cracked how to build very successful partnerships. And so I really wanted to learn how to do that. And also I was very interested on the M&A side. You know, we hadn't really done any significant acquisitions as a startup. And that was a really interesting part of the opportunity and kind of allowed that continuation almost of a founder type role. You know, you get the opportunity to really think a lot long term and to be quite creative, right? You are still company building when you're putting these pieces together. And so that was a really interesting journey to learn how to successfully acquire businesses, how to integrate those together. And as I said, alongside that, the partnership side. So we were, you know, not just acquiring businesses, but we were partnering with a lot wider kind of ecosystem. And that was really interesting. How do you build those kind of successful partnerships, whether it's with kind of smaller software businesses or with the hyperscalers, with the big cloud providers, where we spent a lot of time. So it was a certainly interesting journey. I spent probably about 3 years full-time at Optimizely, which I think is probably longer than the average founder stays post-exit. But it was a really interesting journey. It was a lot to learn. And obviously, it was a very exciting time, you know, in the market, particularly in MarTech, where we were. There was a lot of activity that was great to be a part of.
Yeah, makes great sense. And while you were part of that M&A action, was cloud spending, cloud costs, something that you've been looking at? So I'm just trying to kind of narrow down where you got an idea for cloud capital. And obviously, I mean, for us, I think it's one of the most paraded stories of ours at SaaS Group, where, you know, we bought a company once that was spending almost $1 million per year on cloud costs, and how we were able to optimize it and take it down to 200,000, which was obviously amazing, great ROI almost instantly. So was that something that was a concern for you on the acquirer side?
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, this was a private equity backed business. PE funds tend to care about gross margin and operating margin. Yeah, and we acquired a lot of businesses very quickly, including some pretty large scale companies. So we ended up with about 70 million a year of annual cloud spend through those acquisitions. So that was a large amount of money in absolute terms, but also relative to our revenue, was a pretty chunky part of our gross margin. So it was sort of a, let's go buy a bunch of companies, let's have a big strategy around how we're going to drive, you know, a unification here. But we also need to look carefully at the costs and managing the costs and understanding those. And obviously cloud was, you know, the second largest line item after a headcount. And it was a large, large investment. And also at the same time, I was then helping to drive forwards our partnerships with some of the cloud providers. We were actually not just working with Microsoft and Google and AWS as cost centers for us, but actually as strategic partners could help us drive growth. So it was a major area of focus. I was very fortunate. I was working kind of more on the finance side. I was very fortunate to be working with two other people who had actually come in through a couple of those acquisitions, who were working on the product and engineering side. And we kind of worked as a cross-functional team to better understand, you know, what are we spending on cloud infrastructure? Why are we actually spending that? You know, it became one of those areas that was least well understood about our own business. And we realized, you know, that the bill, when it lands, is a lagging indicator, right? By the time you see the bill, the mistakes you've made are already locked in. And so, you know, it's very easy, I think, for most people to kind of think of cloud as a technical problem, but actually it's a control problem. It was the, you know, second largest line item, as I said, but also the least understood. And so we all work very closely together. What's nice is actually those two people, Zach and Spencer, are now my co-founders. So we all came together through Optimizely, through acquisitions of the various startups. And then, you know, our job really was, you know, paired together, kind of figure out how do we take control of this cloud spend, understand it, optimize it, deliver greater efficiency and predictability, and obviously help support the strategy from the private equity owners.
Yeah, that makes sense. And, you know, you were talking about understanding where it's all coming from and whether, you know, people understand the trends in their cloud spend. But what is basically this magical efficient cloud span? Is there a benchmark that we should all be secretly looking
at? Well, it's a very good question. And I think a lot of really struggle to understand, you know, I'm spending X today. Just even before I think about getting efficient and understanding where does that sit? Is that good? Is that bad? And we see quite a lot of variance, right? So typically companies are spending somewhere between 10 to 20% of revenue on cloud infrastructure these days. We actually did some market research very recently, which was fantastic. We spent time with about 100 growth stage CFOs of VC-backed and bootstrap businesses, and did a survey and really understand what are they spending on cloud today? How do they forecast that? How do they get level predictability out of that? As I say, yeah, 10 to 20% of revenue spent on cloud. Obviously, if you're an AI startup, you're often spending quite a lot more on cloud infrastructure these days. And also, I think there's big differences in how people operate. So, you know, VC-backed businesses get to kind of kick the can for longer on cloud infrastructure. You know, YC-backed startups these days get about $500,000 worth of free credits thanks to being part of the YC batch. And so, you know, they really don't have to think about cloud for a while, whereas, you know, customer-funded businesses have to think a lot earlier and a lot more carefully about cloud. Right? For every dollar that you make from a customer that's funding your business, you could be essentially paying a 10, 20, even 30% tax, if you like, to your cloud provider to help you run that platform. So, you know, I think when we spent a lot of time, as I said, looking at a whole bunch of different companies when we were out there hunting for potential acquisitions. And it was very interesting to see the different ways that people operated cloud. I mean, as I said, VC-backed startups kind of use their investor capital to subsidize the growth of the business and the gross margin of their business. And so I said, okay, well, we'll figure this out once we get to scale. You looked at bootstrap businesses, they had spent a lot more time on this a lot earlier to try and understand what's actually happening and get control of those spend earlier. I think the reality is also there's a lot of different ways that you can save money on cloud. So there are obvious things like turning things off at the weekend if you're not using them, and, you know, making simple adjustments to your infrastructure around how long you hold data and things like that, all the way through to obviously a lot of engineering effort involved in re-architecting infrastructure and building new versions of your platform that are more efficient. Those all are fantastic and you know, can really drive a lot of savings, but they often require big engineering investments. And again, if you're going to a bunch of your engineering resources and divert them over to re-architecting or optimizing your infrastructure, there can be a big opportunity cost as well. You're going to spend a lot of time tweaking that cloud spend bill down a little bit. That time could have been spent developing new capabilities, scaling your platform for your customers and so on. So it's often a big challenge of kind of how much time do you spend optimizing versus driving innovation. One of the big ways that, you know, you can really optimize your spend without that kind of engineering investment is if essentially you're prepared to move from the pay-as-you-go model that most companies start with. So if you found a business, what you tend to do on pretty much on day one is stick your credit card into AWS or Google, and you know, you pay as you go at the end of the month for whatever you used. And that's fantastic when you're getting going, because it gives you a lot of flexibility. You can kind of, you know, experiment and innovate using different services from your cloud provider very easily without having to worry about, you know, making big decisions and long-term decisions. And that's, as I said, fantastic as you're getting going. But actually, as you start to scale, you can quickly realize that paying that on-demand price means you're paying a significant premium. Most of the cloud providers offer huge discounts. You're prepared to move from that on-demand price to a more fixed long-term commitment. So if you're prepared to say, actually, I'm going to put my money where my mouth is, I'm going to commit to using a server for a year or for 3 years, you can get very, very significant discounts. And that's very helpful, because you can save money without a lot of engineering effort just by making those kind of commitments. But they come with huge risks. At Optimizely, we made hundreds of millions of commitments to the cloud providers. And those are some pretty stressful decisions to make when you make those kind of long-term commitments.
And they're probably even more stressful these days with AI. I mean, you wake up and all of a sudden you went viral, and then you have a bill of a couple hundred thousand dollars.
Absolutely. Or you've realized that actually, because it's scaled very quickly, you made a bunch of commitments to stuff you don't need anymore, right? Actually, you need to re-architect what you're doing, and suddenly instead of needing server A, you need server B. And you've already made a 3-year commitment to the first bit of infrastructure, and you're suddenly on the hook for paying for something you don't need. And that can be very, very costly and very difficult to manage, right? Making those kind of long-term decisions these days, making a commitment for 3 years feels like making a commitment for 30 years in the startup world. And so a lot of companies aren't able to make those kind of long-term investment decisions. And as I said, you know, and I think you had a similar kind of experience, you know, when you are looking at potential acquisitions, you can quickly see actually individual companies on their own don't have maybe the financial risk tolerance to make those decisions or the expertise to be able to figure out which decisions to make. You bring them into a larger organization, you have more capability on both those fronts, you can very, very quickly reduce that spend. And a lot of, you know, private equity backed businesses and roll-ups actually do a lot of this work to say, okay, the moment we acquire a company, we have an opportunity to reduce their cloud spend. We have the opportunity to obviously improve their gross margin, their operating margin very, very quickly, which is tough, right? As a bootstrap founder, as an early stage founder, you just don't have the capabilities, the capacity, the financial tolerance to make those kind of savings where others.
Absolutely. But maybe tell me more a little bit on the whole AI, you know, how it changes the cloud spend patterns. And maybe if you have, you know, because you've shared a little bit of the hacks and how to reduce the cloud spend maybe, but what do you do with AI? How do you maybe not reduce it, but at least are able to keep an eye on it?
Yeah, well, AI, I think, has changed a lot about cloud. First of all, it just means people are spending a lot more on cloud infrastructure these days, right? It's a lot more compute intensive to run an AI native business than it is to run a kind of more traditional SaaS business. You're processing a lot more data. Obviously, if you're training models, that's a huge expense. But even, you know, a lot of businesses these days aren't training their own foundational LLM, but they're still using, you know, one of the off-the-shelf providers. They're putting a lot more data through that. They're connecting that with their existing platform or with their new platform. So as I said, we're seeing, first of all, people spending significantly more as a percentage of revenue on cloud infrastructure in the kind of new AI space. I think the second side of this is actually, it's also been a huge financial change for the cloud providers themselves. So kind of cloud was very successful over its first era, if you like, the pre-AI era, because ultimately, whether it was Amazon Web Services or Google Cloud or Microsoft Azure, they were ultimately running on pretty commodity, fairly cheap, fairly high margin infrastructure. So they could go build a data center and they could use cheap chips in cheap servers with, you know, open source software. And they therefore could be quite flexible. If these servers were being used one day and then not the next, it wasn't a complete nightmare. Their whole economics have changed enormously in the last 24 months, right? They are investing billions and billions of dollars in very expensive chips with very expensive hardware and making huge long-term investments in the expected growth around AI. Big investments on their side are making them very enthusiastic to get companies to make these kind of long-term commitments. If I'm going to spend $1 billion building a data center, I really need to know that my customer is going to use that. And so there's going to be much, much more pressure on companies, not just large, you know, AI labs and enterprise businesses, but into the startup world to move from those kind of pay-as-you-go models to the much more committed pricing models to back the huge investments the cloud providers themselves have been making at the hardware level. A lot of the principles around how you save money are actually quite similar. I think we, as I said, we did some market research on the cost of compute. And at the moment, AI represents about 22% of total compute costs. Obviously, that's up from very little just a few years ago. So it's growing very quickly. If you're, you know, an AI native business or you're integrating AI into your existing SaaS product, actually, you know, there are huge costs all around, as I said, around data processing, data storage, and so on. So actually, the cost management challenges still actually go way broader than, are you using GPUs? Are you training models? And so a lot of the same strategies apply. It's about getting a greater control over how you're managing your data, how you're storing that data, making the same kind of commitments, if you can, to actually drive down those costs. The biggest challenge is actually about, not about necessarily the strategies to save money, but actually it's about predicting what your spend is going to be like. I think, you know, traditional SaaS businesses, they have a greater degree of predictability, right? If I assign a new customer, I kind of understand how they might use that product and what kind of usage will drive in terms of costs. When you have a new AI product, whether you're a brand new startup launching native, cloud native or AI native, or if you're launching a new embedded capability or a new add-on AI capability, there's just a lot less certainty around how many customers are going to use this, what's the kind of usage patterns. It's, you know, it's a leap into the unknown. It's a very big area of innovation for a lot of companies. And so, you know, you're launching this out, actually understanding what's that going to mean? How do we model, you know, what's the likely cost of that infrastructure over the next 12 months or 36 months? That becomes a lot more difficult. Even if the strategies for saving money are kind of the same, making the and therefore making those kind of long-term commitments is even more challenging, right? To say, okay, I'm now just launching a new AI product, I really want to make sure I'm not burning through my cash. I'm not, you know, paying, as I said, a big tax to my cloud provider to provide that product. But I have no idea how many customers are going to be using this. It could be 10, or it could go viral and I have 10 million customers using this very, very quickly. And that is the sort of lack of predictability, lack of control. I think any founder gets pretty nervous about.
Yeah, absolutely. So, okay, let's get a little deeper into what you do with Cloud Capital. And, you know, correct me if I'm wrong. For me, when I was trying to understand what you guys are doing and what the model is, it sounded a bit like insurance for, you know, how much somebody's going to spend on cloud cost. So you're helping them make that bet. And basically, if they're below the threshold, then that's what you're getting. But if they're above, then that's kind of the insurance that you're paying off to the company that's working with you. And first of all, did I get that right?
You did a very good
job. Sorry for calling it insurance.
No, that's absolutely fine. Yeah, it's a very similar concept. So as I said, I think most companies are spending a lot on cloud. It's pretty unpredictable. So they obviously want predictability, but they also want efficiency. They want to get there without spending thousands of hours of precious engineering time on, you know, optimization. So the key way is, can I, you know, instead of spending time reducing how much I'm using or focusing as much on that, how can I just get a better price for everything I use? As I said, the key way you can do that is through making these long-term commitments, but they come with a big risk, right? If I sign up to paying for a server for 3 years, and then, you know, in year two or year three, I end up not needing that, I'm still on the hook for paying for something I'm not using. You know, I can very easily wipe out all of my savings. So that's where Cloud Capital comes in, very much based on our experience at Optimizee, where we were making these long-term, you know, commitments. We were trying to build forecasts and understand what we're going to spend in order to make a 1, 3, or 5 year commitment to one of the cloud providers. It came out of that to realize that this is a problem everyone faces, and maybe we can help solve it. And really, there are kind of two areas that we help. One is around forecasting. So we provide a free product that enables customers to forecast out their cloud spend. So taking into account, you know, not just what are you spending today, but what are your growth projections, what's your engineering roadmap, and kind of triangulating between those three data points to give you a much clearer view of actually over the next 12 months, if we're going to grow our customer base 50% and we're going to launch XYZ features and new capabilities, what's our spend actually going to look like over those 12 months, and give you a lot more certainty and predictability around that. And then the second thing is that actually we can make those commitments, those long-term customer commitments on the customer's behalf. And what that means is they can benefit from the savings, but we actually take on the financial risk. So replay that scenario. You know, we make a 3-year commitment on a customer's behalf to a particular server. They benefit from the big discount that they get from that. But then if at, you know, year two, they no longer need that server, we actually continue to pay for that and they don't have to. So in that sense, it allows them to benefit from the good side of those commitments without the downside risk of ending up with something, you know, paying for something you don't use. And yeah, we manage that as a financial instrument. So we operate much more like a bank, really, in that respect, saying, you know, managing or understanding using the forecast, what is the likelihood that they're going to use this commitment, managing a capital reserve. So we set aside capital to cover for that scenario where they don't need a commitment for a particular period of time. And that allows us to manage that risk and understand that risk. As you say, kind of a similar model in some respects to insurance. But yeah, it's a financial product. And that's what these commitments are, right? They're not a technology. They're really a financial instrument. They're almost like a loan or a mortgage where you're taking on a financial liability. And just with like any other financial product, there's a risk that's there that we can understand and price and manage. And, you know, customers are very happy. They get, you know, discounts on their cloud spend. We actually, as I said, support commitments. We also provide a volume discount. So we can actually give customers not just commitment-based savings, but also up to 5% discount across their entire cloud bill, which is very helpful as well. So customers are very, very happy with that. And also the cloud providers. So as I said, they're making big CapEx investments in building data centers. They want commitments and they want those commitments to be paid out. They don't want those to not actually, you know, pay out over that 3-year term. So we support that. They always get certainty that this particular server is going to get paid for the next 3 years. they have that predictable revenue stream coming in. Their sales team are very happy because they're getting paid on those kind of longer term commitments. And the customer gets the benefit of the savings, but retains all the flexibility and autonomy they need as they're scaling their business.
This episode is sponsored by Rewardful. Looking for new ways to find customers for your SaaS business? Consider building an affiliate program. Rewardful is the easiest affiliate tracking platform to set up, manage, and scale for SaaS companies. Building a successful affiliate program can be a little bit intimidating at first, and that's why Rewardful has taken what they've observed from their most successful customers' affiliate programs and distilled that into an exclusive online course. The exciting part? Their affiliate marketing course is absolutely free. Start the course at academy.rewardful.com. Academy.rewardful.com. And turn your biggest fans into your best marketers.
So that's just my assumption. You probably don't work with AI native early stage founders just yet.
Oh, we do actually. So I think it's kind of interesting. You know, we typically have been working with sort of what we would call growth stage technology businesses in the traditional SaaS world, but actually, you know, in AI, the cloud as a cost, as a line item, becomes a much bigger problem much earlier. So we have pretty early stage AI businesses where we're helping with the volume savings and with the commitment optimization, and also obviously helping them to create a financial forecast and a model for their cloud spend that factors in what happens if we grow 10%? What happens if we grow 100% a month? What's our spend going to look like? What are the opportunities to make those kind of commitments and optimization? What's very nice is that, you know, we've built this from the ground up to work with startups. So whilst we have some experience going from startup world all the way up into kind of scaled up business, we built this to work with early stage businesses because that's actually where the pain is, you know, most acute. It's the area where you have the least certainty about what's going to happen with your business, and yet the most need to manage your cash and your runway as carefully as possible. And so we really build it to make sure that, kind of going back to our roots as early stage founders and bootstrap founders, that, you know, this is something that could help people along that entire journey.
Yeah, I was just thinking more, you know, about you guys, because, I mean, AI now is absolutely wild. I mean, what if you make a commitment for something and they're lovable? And, you know, then what do you do? So I'm very interested in, you know, the ways that you are able to predict that cloud spend and, you know, commit to it.
Yeah, absolutely. So if they're lovable, if they're growing faster than anticipated, that's a good thing, right? So we can help them manage and scale up their savings as they grow. So every time, you know, they're launching a new server, we can model and understand, is that something they're launching just for an hour or for a minute, or is that something that's more likely to be used over a longer time period? And then we can automate the process of scaling up the commitments to match that growing spend. I think the key is, you know, That's all great if there's a level of predictability. If you zoom out, everything looks like it's, you know, a hockey stick up and to the right. But actually underneath, there's probably a high degree of volatility in any one of these startups as new customers come on board, but then other customers leave. And in the midst of all of that, you're probably re-architecting various parts of the platform multiple times over very, very quickly to make it scale and perform. And it's that volatility that's very difficult for companies to manage. So even if you're growing very rapidly and saying, oh, if I make commitments today, that's fine because I'll be, you know, 10 times the size next month. Actually, you may need completely different things next month, right? You may actually have switched infrastructure, switched services, switched into a new architecture. And even if your spend has doubled overnight, it could be on completely different things. And that's the risk that a lot of customers, you know, really struggle with, is if I'm going to make long-term commitments, I can save money, but I may actually end up having locked myself into an architecture that's not going to scale. And so I need to be able to move to a different systems very quickly without having that kind of financial lock-in. And that's how we really help.
Okay. All right. Thank you. Yeah, that makes great sense. I wanted to also ask you, you know, about the company itself, because you guys also use AI. And again, from my previous conversation with Darshan, I think he said something really interesting. He said, we are, what was it? A human-wrapped AI. So I thought it was really great term. So yeah, what does it mean? And, you know, at what point you think that, you know, AI is great and all, but maybe this is still a task for a human?
Yeah, it's a really good question. So I think, you know, first of all, we're either second or third time founders, and we have a lot of kind of veteran team members that we've been building our super group of our best team members from all of our previous startups. So, you know, this time round, we spent a lot more time thinking about the problem, thinking about the financial economics, the unit economics of this business before we started. But we started Cloud Capital back in late 2024. And so there's, you know, really building second time round or third time round, but as AI native, and understanding that actually everything we'd learned before needed to be, you know, reimagined now. And I think the opportunity that we've seen, obviously, we work with AI businesses. We have an AI-led product in terms of how it understands people's spend and forecasts their spend and kind of makes these important commitment decisions. But we've also adopted, you know, AI within the business as well, very, very proactively. And the way we kind of think about it is almost wisdom plus AI is the powerful combination. So we think that it's possible to scale the business in terms of revenue far faster than you have to scale in terms of headcount these days. And, you know, the powerful combination is if you put someone who has strong foundational understanding of a particular domain, whether it's marketing, sales, you know, or in engineering, in data science, and then you support them with AI tools and a infrastructure and framework that allows them to use those tools very effectively, then they can get far more done far quicker than we ever were able to before. So I think, you know, probably our headcount today is probably 30 or 40% less than we had originally anticipated, just because I don't think early on in the process, we probably underestimated the impact of AI within the company and what we could achieve with those tools within the business. But I think AI is potentially a dangerous weapon. Right? In the wrong hands, if you can do things very, very quickly and you can execute very quickly, in the wrong hands, it means you can go off in the wrong direction if you're not aware. And so that's where we've really focused, is sort of saying, okay, if we can bring in talent that has really, really strong foundational understandings in building the right architecture, whether it's an engineering, you know, decisions or building the right marketing framework and really understanding what we need to do, if you then have that right direction and right foundation, then you can use AI to scale really, really quickly in the right way. I get nervous about, you know, putting AI in the hands of people who haven't, frankly, had enough time to make some of those mistakes that we all have to make, because you can potentially go off in the wrong direction very, very quickly. So that's how we've thought about it. And I think also it's just an acceptance that, as I said, what you've learned before, you know, always apply going forwards. And, you know, second, third time round, it can be tempting to go, well, I know how to do this, and we did it this way before, so we've got to do it this way again. Actually, you know, see, the world changes very, very quickly, and being open to, you know, actually new approaches is always important if you can have that, you know, kind of foundational understanding that you can apply, you know, and scale in kind of the right way.
Great point. I absolutely agree. I mean, we do so much with AI. I think when we started a talk group with AI, we had this approach of saying, you know, we're already behind. Let's imagine that we're already behind. Let's try and do everything that we can and experiment with absolutely all the tools out there. And at first, obviously, it created a bit of a FOMO and, you know, oh my God, we know nothing about AI and how it works and, you know, what it's capable of. But we all had the foundation, like you said, and we all knew where we were going. And it was like this one goal and direction where we were moving. So I think that made it a lot easier. And when we figured out, okay, we are not going to just disperse and use everything that internet has to offer, but only the tools that really work for us, then yeah, it calmed down quite a bit. And now it's a great tool to just optimize for everything that we need to do. But enough with AI. I mean, I haven't had one episode not about AI this year. It's crazy. And I wanted to ask you about partnerships, because you said back in your first venture, you weren't able to crack strategic partnerships. And I think in SaaS, partnerships can be just a super tool for growth. So do you think you can first of all apply that knowledge that you already have here at Cloud Capital. And do you think that you maybe know a way with partnerships that could work now?
Yeah, I think it's really interesting. I think certainly when we were building IDEO, so that was 2013 to 2019, there was a huge focus on direct sales and marketing, right? There was a kind of predictable revenue playbook that everyone was running and saying, okay, I'm going to build out the sales and marketing engine that, you know, is mostly direct in-house. And there was a sort of skepticism towards building partnerships. You know, it's going to take a long time, a long investment. You've got to enabling another organization to help drive your growth. Is that worth that investment? How predictable, how controllable is that? So I think there was a sort of reticence on the part of a lot of investors to, you know, allow or encourage their portfolio companies to make these kind of investments in partnerships, as opposed to just go hire some more SDRs or some more salespeople. That's much more predictable. Let's drive growth that way. But actually, I think what you see is, you know, whilst direct is controllable, it's actually a really high cost of acquisition. So if you're spending a lot of money, particularly on an enterprise sales motion to acquire new customers, it puts a lot of pressure on all the other unit economics. Whereas, you know, actually partnerships has the potential to scale much, much more efficiently. If you can partner with another organization or a larger organization, enable their team to help, you know, acquire customers, help sell your product that's a huge area of leverage. I would also say it's a great opportunity to validate the capability of your product with a potential acquirer. Yeah, and at Optimizely, we partnered with a lot of companies that we were looking to acquire, whether it's those specific companies or in that category. And so there's a kind of huge win-win there where you get to scale your business through a partner who may be a potential acquirer, or their competitor may be an acquirer, and so on. So it has huge potential. At IDEO, we never, I felt, really cracked the partnership side. And I think probably because we just didn't quite understand how to build a partner value proposition, and probably also to understand your kind of ideal partner profile. We were very customer centric, as I think everyone should be, and really thinking very carefully about, you know, who are the companies that we're targeting, what's our ideal customer, what's the value proposition for them. And so we took that approach and sort of went out to a bunch of partners who also worked with our customers and said, oh, well, we provide value to these organizations, you do too, therefore there must be an obvious partnership opportunity. Focus very much on that end value proposition to the customer. In reality, those partnerships didn't accelerate the way we wanted to. And it was only Optimizely that I spent some time on this and really started to understand that whilst, yes, you know, partnering with people who obviously work alongside you, a customer, makes a lot of logical sense. You might want to integrate your products together, make it easier for your customers to use the two different solutions. But actually, you need to invest time and effort in really understanding what is the value to the partner. You want their sales organization, their marketing organization, to be really motivated to help, you know, you scale. If you're sat on the other side, if you're part of the go-to-market team of a large technology company, and you have, you know, probably 50 or 100 smaller partners that you could bring into a sales cycle, you, first of all, you realize as a sales rep, if I bring a third party into this sales process, it's going to create risk and uncertainty, whatever happens, right? I'm bringing in another solution that has a different sales motion or a different value proposition. So I'm always making that kind of cost benefit decision of, if I bring a third party in, is it really going to help me close this deal? Or is it actually going to disrupt that? So what you need to do as a partner is really think, okay, not just how am I going to help the end customer, but how am I actually helping the partner? How am I going to help them close this deal faster, more easily, and, you know, help them compete more effectively against whoever their competitors are, and focus much more on that. It's what we've done at Cloud Capital, actually, and we took that lesson very much to heart in not just how we're kind of executing, but in how we design the business from the ground up. So as I mentioned, you know, we help customers save money and retain that kind of flexibility and autonomy around their cloud infrastructure. But from a cloud provider perspective, we really help them secure bigger commitments for longer, far more easily. And, you know, they have large scale sales organizations whose job all day, every day is to go to companies and try and convince them to make, you know, 3-year commitments. That's a very difficult thing to do as a sales rep at AWS or Google. You know, you're trying to convince an early stage unpredictable business to make a 3-year contractual commitment to using cloud infrastructure, often with some baked in growth and other, you know, other things. And that organization doesn't really know how to make that decision, doesn't have the financial risk tolerance to make that decision, doesn't have the forecasting capabilities to make that decision, and they don't want to share all of their confidential information with you as a sales rep at AWS so that you can make that decision for them. That's not going to happen. So we recognize that, you know, the customer has a certain set of motivations, and so do the sales reps. And if we can actually bridge those two and build a business that bridges that, that we can actually help the customers, but also help these sales reps and kind of built the value proposition at that grassroots level and said, you know, rather than relying on a big strategic partnership announcement and a bunch of marketing around a partnership as a way of driving growth, actually, let's first of all make sure that it really works for each individual sales rep and actually helps them, you know, hit quota faster, helps them build better customer relationships. And that's how to kind of build that partnership almost from the bottom up rather than the top down.
Yeah, amazing. I think when I was starting doing any kind of partnerships for SaaS Group, I remember the first thought that I always had was, okay, if somebody came to me with that proposition, would I be like, no, and close the email? Or would I be like, huh, okay, interesting. Yeah, let's see what we can do here. Yeah. And yeah, I think it helped a lot to really drive partnerships that made sense. And now, you know, I'm very happy that every time we do something, it's basically the same setup of us plus sponsors. It hasn't really changed over the 2.5 years that we've been doing something with them. So yeah, that's a great thing to remember. Well, I only have 2 short questions for you, and they are the usuals here. So, you know, 20 years building something, doing something. I'm still, wow, very impressed. What do you think has been the biggest win and the biggest failure? And it can be just for you as a founder, or it can be for, you know, either one of the companies.
I think the biggest win and the biggest failure often come at the same time, which is as a founder, you have to be able to kind of run at a brick wall and keep going. And kind of build that airplane just as you take off. Sometimes that doesn't work out, and sometimes, you know, things don't go the way you want. That's absolutely fine, right? And recognizing that sort of 90% plus of startups fail, and therefore, if you run out of that brick wall and you hit that brick wall, that's okay, and you have almost certainly developed amazing skills in the meantime. You can reapply those the next time around and so on. So I think that's probably the biggest learning, is maintaining that kind of energy level and enthusiasm. And I think a lot of that comes from just working with other people who are willing to take that leap. And, you know, it's often really motivating to work with others who are prepared to jump and build the plane on the way down. And hopefully it will fly. But if it doesn't, then, you know, you have an opportunity to move on and do something new. So I've been through that journey a few times. I don't think I would ever do anything else.
Amazing. You know, which reminded me of, like, because a lot of people say, you know, SaaS, building a SaaS or any business is lots of ups and downs. And there were a lot of referrals to building an airplane while you're flying. And maybe, I don't know if you've watched it ever, but Red Bull has this competition where you have to build a plane out of like all kinds of crap and see if it flies. So
I think they sometimes they do feel like you've just strapped some wings to a bicycle. I think sometimes, but that's what you have to do until you learn how to build a better plane and a better plane and a better plane. So it's always fun to watch those and realize that, you know, maybe that's the startup you've got right now, but it doesn't always have to be that way.
Yeah, absolutely. All right. And, you know, the last one's always about a hack. And again, it can be anything that works for you, works for the company, maybe something about, you know, your mental health or anything really that you think other founders would appreciate.
I love going for a walk. I think the challenge of being sat in front of your screen all day, every day, particularly sat in front of your screen, is really challenging to stay focused, stay motivated. I think one of the best ways to, you know, to keep your energy levels up and keep your focus up is actually to go for walks. I love doing walking meetings. I love getting some fresh air. I think often some of those are the most productive sessions, is when you're not actually sat looking at the screen. You're just talking to someone as you're moving. So I always recommend that if you can, even at this cold time of year, you can get out and enjoy a walking meeting.
Maybe we should do a new format of the podcast.
There you go. Yeah. Perfect.
So that could be pretty cool. All right. Well, thank you, Ed. It's been great talking to you. Like I said, I've heard quite a bit about Cloud Capital from Tarshan, having worked with him a little bit while he was still in Paddle. And it's a great story. I think you're solving a very interesting problem. So yeah, looking forward to seeing you hopefully at one of our events.
Definitely.
SaaS Group. But also just looking forward to seeing what you're building in the future.
Fantastic. Well, thanks very much for the invitation. It was great. Thank you.
Absolutely. Same here. And take care. Thanks for listening. SaaS Unbound is brought to you by SaaS Group. We're a long-term home for great B2B SaaS. We buy, keep the team and brand DNA, and help with the boring stuff like hiring and finance so founders can truly focus on building great products. If you're a founder who'd like to be featured or explore an acquisition, reach out through the form on our website or email me at anna@saas.group.